Last time I spoke here, I spoke on the genealogy of Messiah, and I said, in the genealogy, Matthew does something strange. He includes women, and normally in the Old Testament, you don't include women, and so Matthew points out that Jesus came to save men and women. Today, I want to continue that theme to some degree, that saving aspect of why Jesus came. And I want to look at the first worshippers of Messiah and see where they fit in and what it is that they do and what we can learn from them. Turn with me to Luke. It's a long reading, so we won't read through the whole. I'm sure you're familiar with it because we've just read that at Christmas time. We all have, haven't we? Most of you would have. The first worshippers are the shepherds, and the shepherds are uneducated. They're not very rich. They're just wandering around with their sheep. When we look at Hollywood or some other traditional types of media, we can see that they make some huge blunders, and I want to tackle some of those blunders, and I want to tackle also the year that Jesus was born in, and perhaps even look at a little bit closer. Because when do you think Jesus was born? 1 AD? That's not quite right, because Herod actually dies in 4 before Christ. And Herod is still alive, isn't he, when Jesus is born? So that means that Jesus got to be born before 4 before Christ. Yeah, it doesn't make sense, does it? I'm glad that some of you are awake. Some of you still have to wake up. Okay, let's see if we can pinpoint when he was born. Herod dies 4 BC, so Jesus got to be born before 4 BC. Quirinius is governor, and he is governor around 8 BC. So somewhere in between 4 and 8. Herod actually lives the last year of his life, not in Jerusalem, but in Jericho, because after the slaughter of the children, he departs from Jerusalem because the Jewish people are not very happy with what he did, and he lives over there. So at least 5 BC, perhaps even we can narrow it a little bit further, because the wise men or the magi came to Herod, and Herod seems to imply 2 years earlier, so perhaps 7 BC. Can we pinpoint a day? There's a popular preacher that goes around and he says, well, it's definitely not the 25th of December. I don't know how he does that. And then he gives the reasons, because it's winter time. Well, that's true. And you never put sheep out in winter. Now, this American preacher, I don't know where exactly he's from. He's got an American voice. Maybe he's Canadian. I don't know. My apologies to the Canadians. But it's true that if you lived in Canada or in Scandinavia, you wouldn't put your sheep out in the fields in winter because they would freeze to death. But if you lived in Israel, it's the Middle East. It's actually the rainy season. From October to about March, it's rainy season. You got fresh grass. If I was a shepherd, I would have my sheep out there. Now, don't get me wrong. I don't know what day he was born. Maybe it was the 26th of January, anticipation of Australia Day. I don't know. The Bible doesn't tell me. And so I do know that he was born roughly in between 6 and 7 BC. That seems to fit. But the day, don't know. This particular preacher then goes on and says, it was a Jewish holiday. Now Luke, when he writes his gospel, he speaks to Mary, because we read that she has a dream and she spoke and she keeps these things in her heart. Do you think that Mary would have told Luke, by the way, my firstborn, my son, the Messiah, he was born on, and then he names that Jewish holiday. Luke doesn't write that. It was just an ordinary day. No holiday, no nothing special about that birth at all. What do we see in this chapter, though? And that's what I do want to focus on, because I do want to get to the truth rather than anything else. The birth of Jesus. Shepherds are out in the field, and an angel of the Lord appeared to them, and the glory of the Lord shone around them. When was the last time in the Old Testament that we saw that glory? Anybody want to make a guess? Yeah, Moses saw the glory, but we get it later. I said the last time, not one of the first times. It's in the book of Ezekiel, nearly 500 years earlier. In Ezekiel chapters 9 and 10 describe the departing of the glory. So for almost 500 years, things have been pretty quiet. You had a few preachers at the end there, like Malachi. But the glory has departed, and suddenly this glory comes back and steps into their life. The glory is known in some circles with a different name. Does anybody know that name? The Shekinah. Shekinah comes from the word shachan in the Hebrew, meaning to dwell, because it was the localized presence of God. It was the divine manifest presence of God. And so they see the angel, and they see the Shekinah glory. And what do? They fear. Moses feared, Ezekiel feared, and these shepherds feared. It's interesting when you read some of these very popularized kind of, I don't want to call them fiction because they may not be, but accounts of people who meet angels, and they seem to have a good time. Every time I read of an encounter like this, they fear. They're afraid of their lives. Zechariah, John's father, what did he do? He feared. The angel tells him this will be a sign to you. You'll find a babe wrapped in swaddling cloth, and he will be lying in a manger. Now, why was there no room in the inn? You got to remember, the holiday inn, or the holy day inn at that time, it was a one-room affair. It was a small room. And so Bethlehem is fairly close to Jerusalem. People would go up to Jerusalem to worship. And so if you would be in that one hotel room with everybody else, because you're sharing the space, and somebody would give birth, there would be blood involved. Everybody would be defiled. I'm sorry, you got to go home for a week, and then you can come back and worship. You don't want to, as a hotel keeper, you don't want to mix that, do you? That's going to cost you business. So the hotel, the innkeeper says, sorry, no space. You're about to give birth. I can't take that risk. Everybody will walk out, and I've got to give their money back. It wasn't sound advice, knowing who was coming, but he didn't know. And so the shepherds are not looking for a house. They're looking for a cave. You see, wood is expensive. If you want to chop down a tree, that's easy to do today. But back then, there were tree tax. And so the only trees you had on your land were fruit trees or olive trees or trees that produce something. There's no wooden little barn, but he was born in a cave. And he's wrapped in swaddling cloth. What does that mean? Do you have swaddling cloth lying around? No. Do you know what swaddling cloth is? There's one reference in the Old Testament, Job 38:9, and there's another one in the New Testament with Lazarus. Lazarus, come forth, and you can wrap that cloth away from him. It's burial cloth. They're strips of linen. How many of you, when you were born, were wrapped in burial cloth? Anybody? I guess it doesn't make great material. Back then, though, in caves, Jewish people outside of the city, they would keep burial cloth in caves. So that when somebody died, you got to bury them within 24 hours, they would take them to the cave, wrap them up, put ointment on them, roll a stone in front of the cave, and leave them there for a year. And then after a year, you come back, take out the bones, and you bury them in an ossuary, in a bone box. We don't do that anymore, but back then that was common practice. And so Jesus is born in one of those caves. There probably weren't a lot of donkeys and camels lying around. It wasn't a cave like that. But the shepherds knew where those caves were because it was bad weather. You would hide in there. The symbolism is not to be missed, though. Jesus is the king of all of eternity, of heaven and earth. And he's born in the place of what? In a cave. He is wrapped in burial cloth on his first day and last day of his life. He came to die for you and me. We want to live, but he came to die. It's a symbolism we shouldn't miss. But because of these two clues, the Jewish shepherds found the babe easily. which is good. And so we see the first worship of the messianic person, the first worship of Christ. And when he was 8 days old, they circumcised him. Most little boys, when you ask them, do you want to be circumcised, don't put their hands up. They probably would say, hey, snip your own doodle-doo. Thank you very much. Don't want that. But we got to remember that there are two things here. There's the Abrahamic covenant, and it's a sign of his Jewishness. And so the parents are faithful in that. And the Mosaic covenant, because he had to be born under the law, Galatians 4, because he would come to redeem those under the law. Galatians 4:4, born of a woman, born under the law, for the purpose to fulfill the law. And so that's what he came for, to fulfill that law. What do the shepherds do? Verse 17, the shepherds go out. And when they had seen him, they spread word concerning him of what they had been told about this child. Put it together. They were afraid. They had godly fear. Then they spread that message all over the world. We call that evangelism, isn't it? You spoke about that last week, John. God seems to put these things together. And they glorified and praised God. And we've been singing about that this morning. And so when we put it together, feared God, shared the message, glorified and praised God. Let's come back to the reading, though, because the reading was from Matthew. So turn with me to Matthew, please. Matthew chapter 2. Because in Matthew chapter 2, we see the first Gentile worship. We've seen the first Jewish worship. Now let's look at the first Gentile worship. We three kings of Orient are. Remember that Christmas carol, anybody? Most of you. Do you sing it? I hope not. We three kings of Orient are. Where in the Bible does it say that they're from the Orient? It doesn't. It says that they're from the East. From the East in Israel is, and in the Bible, it's always Babylon or Babylonia. Where does it say kings? It doesn't. It says magi or astrologers or wise men. Where does it say three? Well, there are three gifts, but it doesn't say three for the people. So I hope you don't sing theological blunders. I mean, I have in the past, and I hope you'll forgive me for that. But we shouldn't sing that, should we? We should stop and let that part go on. I'm sure you'll forgive me for that. In the Western tradition of the church, we see that these kings even have names. The Catholic Church still maintains that. And in the Eastern Church, they have different names. There's still three kings, but they have different names. And they come from different locations. One comes from Africa, one from China or India, and the other one comes from Europe. I don't know how they got that out of the passage, because the passage says that they came from Babylonia. It's also done in the movie Ben-Hur. It's a great movie, but theologically not sound. Okay, so do not take advice from Ben-Hur. Take advice from the Holy Book. Stick to that and stick to a literal reading, unless the text says this can't be true. I think there were enough of them, and probably more than three, because all of Jerusalem is in an uproar about it. If you had three wise guys coming from the east, would you be afraid? Would that cause a stir? If you had 20 or 300, I think that would cause a stir. I don't know how many there were, but I suspect there were more than three. It does raise a question, though. Why would Gentile, and Magi means astrologers, why would Gentile astrologers come to worship a Jewish king? I mean, if they had come and worshipped David, I would have said, yeah, it makes some sense. He's a big guy. If they would have come and worshipped Solomon, then I would have said, yeah, this one too, they'll worship it, makes sense. But they don't worship any Jewish king in the past. So why are these Gentile astrologers suddenly here to worship the Jewish king? How did they get to that? Where did they get this from? Huh. It's a strange question, isn't it? I mean, the Bible clearly forbids astrology. Deuteronomy 18, verses 9 to 12. It's quite clear. Actually, in Isaiah 47, verse 13, and Jeremiah 10:12, God calls them the Chofre HaShmayim, the stargazers, and he scorns them, he laughs at them, and he says, it is useless what you're doing. And so, should we be involved in astrology? No. I mean, astronomy is one thing. I mean, you can observe the stars, you can see what they're doing, but should we worship the stars or try to figure out what they're telling us? No. The secret things belong to God, and the things that he has revealed belong to us. Well, he says clearly, don't. And yet there are some books out on Christian astrology. I don't, please, not so right. But this star is a strange star, isn't it? Did you notice that? When I first became a Christian, I was told, well, it's not a star, it's a configuration of planets and meteors and comets and whatever. And I started looking closer at this star and I realized, yeah, it doesn't matter how you put it, it's not going to work. Think about it for a second. It is called his star. Stars in the singular. So it can't be a configuration. It's the one thing. Two, this star leads them from the east to the west. And then it disappears. Now, how many stars do you know that go from east to west and then disappear? And then reappear to take them north to south. Now, that's not a star, is it? Not only that, this star then hovers over one house in Bethlehem. Now, I don't know what kind of stars you know of, but in Astronomy 101, they teach you that our sun is a little star. And if it hovered over your house, the rest of the planet would be gone. And so this is not a literal star. This is one of those passages that we've got to look at and say, what does that mean? The shepherds, they saw an angel and the glory of God. And what do these wise men see? They see the glory of God, because it appears and reappears. It is his brilliance, because that's really the word there. We've interpreted that as star, and that's fine. It's a legitimate translation, but it is really the brilliance, the glory of God. So why would they still come? Why would they call it his star? Who are these people? Isn't that the question? They come from Babylonia. What do we know about Babylonia? Well, there was one of those prophets from old that actually was exiled there, wasn't it? His name was Daniel. And Daniel in chapter 9, verses 24 to 27, actually indicates the timing of Messiah's coming. It's that week's or the seventh prophecy. And these wise men seem to have figured that out, how that fits. Now, why would they have listened to Daniel? Because that's a question we should ask, isn't it? Daniel written in Hebrew and in Aramaic. It wasn't written in the land of Israel. It was written in Babylon. And so there is a connection there. Remember in the book of Daniel, we have Nebuchadnezzar. And he had a dream. And he said, I don't remember the dream, but I want you to interpret it for me. And all the wise men said, no, you tell me the dream and I'll tell you what it means. And the king said, no, you're going to lose your head if you don't tell me the dream that I had and what it means. And nobody knows what to do. And then Daniel steps in and says, well, it's God who revealed your dream to me and I'll tell you what it means. And he is promoted from one of the wise men to the head of the school of astrology. And he's called an astrologer in the Hebrew. Not that he worships the stars, but he worships the creator of the stars. And through that, his writings become really important. And so the wise men who come from Babylonia know now the timing. It's about that time. But they say something else, don't they? They don't say anything about the book of Daniel. They say, we saw his star. So where did they get that from? You got to go further in the Old Testament. Book of Numbers. In the book of Numbers, we find another man from Babylonia. And his name is? He had a donkey. Remember the donkey? Balaam. Balak, the king of Moab, says to the prophet Balaam, come over here and curse these people, these Jews. They're a pest to me. And Balaam says, okay, I'll ask God. No. The answer is no. Okay, if you offer me more money, I'll ask again. And so he asked again and again. And finally, God says, fine, if you want to go, you go. And he's there with the express purpose to curse the Jewish people. Numbers 22 to 24, those are the chapters. And so it is very clear that he sets out to curse them. God then sends that angel with the donkey, and you all remember that. And then he comes to the land, and he stands on Mount Pisgah, and he makes a prophecy. Four prophecies about the Jewish people. And every time he sets out to curse them, God takes over his tongue, and he blesses them. Numbers 24, verse 17. And a star shall arise out of Jacob, to whom the scepter of kingship will be given. Balaam suddenly connects the coming of Messiah with kingship and with a star. And so the Babylonian wise men suddenly have the two prophecies. Now Balaam's writing is found in Jordan, Moab at the time, Edom, all the way up to modern-day Iraq. And so they're on some of the temple walls of pagan gods. But those that are in prophecy, Daniel would have known about. Daniel had a copy of the scriptures with him, but only up to that point. And so when the wise men study what they know, they would have studied basically up to the time of Daniel and what was released to them. What they don't have is a copy of the book of Micah, because Micah is written in the land, and it's written in Hebrew, and it's written around that time, but it's a little bit after the deportation. Micah 5:2 says Messiah would come out of Bethlehem. We had that prophecy. It was recorded by Luke. And he says, hey, he's coming. The wise men then make a connection with the star that they see, the brilliance, the glory of the Lord, and the timing of Daniel. And they come forward and they worship Messiah. Now, where would they come? Well, where's a king born? In a palace. At least in the capital city. So where do they come? They follow the star until it disappears. And so they come to Jerusalem and they cause an uproar. And then they meet Herod. Herod is often called Herod the Great. But if you actually look at what he does, a better name for Herod would be Herod the Paranoid. I mean, he's an old man by now, and if you think that a two-year-old baby is going to take over your throne, well, it will happen. One of his sons or somebody will take over his kingdom. He shouldn't have been afraid. He slaughters most of his children. He slaughters his favorite wife. And Herod the Paranoid would be a much better description. Caesar actually says of him, it'd be better to be a pig in Herod's household than a son, because most of his sons he killed. But he didn't eat pigs. He was a nominal convert to Judaism. Not that he believed in God, because he also built lots of pagan shrines. The wise men then finally come to Bethlehem, and they meet the toddler. He's no longer a baby, and so there's a time lap, possibly 1 to 2 years. And they bring three gifts: gold, frankincense, and myrrh. All three are Old Testament symbolic kind of things, and so we should look at that. Gold, a kingship, particularly on earth. It's a symbol of kingship on earth in Daniel 2 and Daniel 3. Frankincense, it's a symbol of worship for God, for the worship of the deity, Leviticus 2. And myrrh is a symbol of death and sacrifice. It was used as an embalming oil, 2 Chronicles 16 and John 19. The first line out of that song, that Christmas song, may not be true, we three kings of Orient are, but the last line is, though. The last line is God, King, and sacrifice. And that part is true. Put it together. They studied the scriptures. They were obedient to the scriptures. They rejoiced exceedingly when they saw the child, and they came bearing gifts. when we put it together, shepherds feared, they shared evangelism, they went forth and glorified and praised God, they studied the scriptures and were obedient to them, they rejoiced and gave gifts. Isn't that what we're supposed to do? I know that's probably a lot to take in, but Jesus came to save uneducated and educated, the wise and the not so wise, the poor and the rich, male and female, Jew and Gentile, and we can see that within that message. They went out and proclaimed the lordship of Messiah. Let me ask you a question. Do you follow in those footsteps of those first worshippers? I hope you do. I hope you do. I'm certainly trying. I want to close this message because I've been going on for a little bit longer than I should have. And I'll do that in a benediction, and then I'll ask the worship team to come back. How's that? Yiferecha Adonai v'yishmerecha, Yair Adonai panav alecha v'chunecha, v'yasem lecha shalom. The Lord bless you and keep you, and the Lord make his face shine upon you, so that we may see his glory and understand what that means, that we may fear the Lord, that we may walk in his footsteps like the first worshippers did. May we go forth with that same desire to pray and praise, to rejoice, to give, to study, and to share the life that we are called to live. Father, help us to be obedient to the call of Messiah in our lives this day, and like you are for all eternity. In Jesus' name, amen.